every time I read it, it's very inspiring. And there's always different aspects and facets of this sutta, isn't it, that we can bring out. So it's always good. So far we have been looking at the sila section, the right action and right speech. And to me, this is some of the most important aspects of the entire Noble Eightfold Path. If there's anything that we should get right in Buddhism as Buddhist practitioners, it is this foundation thing, the sila, the speech, the action. This is by far the most important thing. So, right, even if we don't do any meditation at all, it's kind of irrelevant. If we get the sila right, it means that we have a lot of, we are doing a lot of things that will give good results later on. Once you get the sila right, and even if you don't meditate, still, if you ever try to sit down, it means that your meditation will be going reasonably well as a consequence. So this is the most important part. Now we're going to move into other aspects. Once you have the sila is in place, then you can move on to how to develop the mind, right? It starts off with the coarser kind of aspects of development, which is body and speech. And then once that is in kind of in place, then the development of the mind happens from that. You have to get the sequence right here, right? You can't kind of do things, jump certain steps. You have to kind of get all the steps right. Otherwise, it doesn't really work out. So that is next on the agenda. And the next passage here is a standard passage in the gradual training. I've skipped some of the passages in the Pali because they're not that relevant in my opinion. But this next one is actually a very beautiful one. And this is about contentment. Right? So this is what this is about. So I'll just read it out for you and then I'll make some comments in a second. So he becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu is content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate, or this, all of these noble virtues, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. Right, very nice and inspiring little passage there about the idea of just being content. The Pali word for content is santuti. Santuti means content. And this is actually what it says here in this particular sutta. It's the word it uses. So the idea here, you can see now we're moving from the ordinary virtues of the world towards the virtues of the mind. When you are content, you don't have much desire or aversion for the things in the world, right? The mind is starting to become peaceful at this point. You're happy with whatever you have. And you can see here the ideal is very high. The idea is just you have an alms bowl. Right, that's the alms food, as the Greek talks about the alms bowl, and you have robes, and that's really all you have. That's the ideal here for being a monastic, whether you are a monk or a nun. So a high standard, very beautiful, and then you're happy with that. You don't want anything else. You don't desire to have, a laptop or anything. I have a laptop with it, that's why I'm saying that. So it's slightly embarrassing, right? I read this out and I think, I'm taking a laptop with me when I travel around it. And so I'm not really living up to the full standard here, but the reason I do that is because it's very handy. You have all the suttas there, you have a bit of email access, so you can kind of stay in contact with Ajahn Brahm and these kind of things, but it's really a bad excuse, right? It would have been much better if I just came, with just my robes and nothing more, and just kind of, that would be really, really nice. So this is the ideal. We don't always live 100% up to this. But at the very least, whatever it is that you have, you are content with that. And it's not just in the monastic life, right? This is also true for lay life as well. Even though you may have a lot of things and stuff, it's good to be content with those things that you have. And so you, whatever it is that you have in life, okay, good enough. This will do. I'm happy with that. And when you do that, you already you find a certain amount of peace by just being content with what you have. And it's not just about the physical possessions. It's about also our mental possessions, our status, our education, our professional, qualifications, or our, whatever we do, like doing for work. Just be happy with what you have, with where you at. And the more you have of this kind of contentment in life, the more kind of the even your mind becomes, right? There's not that attraction or repulsion to things. The mind becomes very even and peaceful. And this is a very good starting point for meditation practice. Because you will notice that in meditation, to be content is such a powerful tool for meditation to work. When you are content, the mind doesn't run all over the place. Right? It's precisely the restless mind is the mind that isn't content. So this is a foundation stone for that. If you tend to be content with what you have in daily life, meditation tends to become much more easy as a consequence. So this, here we have this also this beautiful simile, right? The simile of the bird which flies, goes around with the wings as its only burden. Right? It's not, if your wings are your only burden, it's not too bad, right? It's pretty good. And this is, again, the idea here, that even your ball and rope, they are a little bit of a burden, right? But you can't throw away your own ball, you've got to have those. So a little bit, life is always a little bit burdensome, but you minimize the burden, you take it to the absolute minimum. So, very inspiring little passage, very kind of high standard, but still inspiring, something that all monastics should aspire for, and lay people also to some extent. And part of this, to me, is also the recollection of the Sangha. One of the things that I have been talking about is various ways of giving rise to joy and happiness in your meditation, right? This has been one of the emphases in this retreat, and I will come back to that more later on as well. And so I've been talking about the Buddha Anusati, the recollection of the qualities of the Buddha. Talked about that for a whole hour, I think, before. I've been talking a little bit about the Sila Anusati, the recollection of your conduct when you basically live a good life. Also, I'm not sure if I mentioned Chaga Anusati, the recollection of generosity. And this one here is really almost like a recollection of the Sangha Anusati. Because when you think about the monastic who live such an incredibly simple life, right? All you have, bowl and robe, nothing else, whether you are a monk or a nun, it is actually very inspiring. And the reason it is inspiring is because you realize that if somebody can live a life that is so simple, it means they're getting their happiness from somewhere else. There's something profound about this person, something more than ordinary people can have. And then that inspires you because it promises you that there is something more in this world, right? There's something more to be had. All these things that we, aspire for in ordinary life, that's not the end of it. There's something more profound. Chuck all that away and still you can be happy. In fact, you can be more happy. This is what you see when you read these kind of passages. So it's very, it has this characteristic of Sangha Anusati built into this. And I would recommend you, I'm sure that is one of the reasons why you're also on the Buddhist path, because sometimes you hear about or you see monastics who are really inspiring. And I too find it sometimes very inspiring to think about those monastics in the world who live in a very simple way and live in a way which is very kind of far removed from ordinary society. Yeah. And some of these monastics are found everywhere, actually, where you go around in the Buddhist world. You can find them pretty much everywhere. It's not like one country doesn't have a monopoly on good monastics. They're found everywhere. Especially in countries where there is a lot of forest still, and where you have the kind of the situation is good for these kind of things. So let's, for example, take Sri Lanka, for example. So one of the very well-known monks in Sri Lanka, this was a monk who died a few years ago. I never met him. Ajahn Brahm didn't meet him. But he was a kind of monk who, he started off, he was German by birth. And when he started out maybe in the 1930s or something like that, this was prior to the Second World War. And when he
It was in Germany.
He was a young man. One of the experiences that he told about, this was a Dhamma talk that he gave to Ajahn Brahm. But Ajahn Brahm said this was the best Dhamma talk he has ever heard. Right? That takes quite a bit, you know. Ajahn Brahm has been around for a long time, many very, many powerful teachers, but this was the best one he said that he had ever heard. So, and in this Dhamma talk, one of the things this German monk called Nyala Vimala was his name, he said to Ajahn Brahm, he talked about how he started off on his path of Buddhism. And he said he was in Germany. This time there was hardly any Buddhism in Europe. This was prior to the Second World War. Almost no Buddhism. And one day he was at some kind of a beer garden or something like that. I think he was just maybe passing through or something. And he saw all of these young people. They were there enjoying themselves, drinking beer, right, and this kind of thing that people do everywhere around the world. And as they were enjoying themselves, getting drunk, getting intoxicated, we saw about the intoxications before, right, of feeling alive and drinking, all of these different types of intoxications. As they were doing that, they were in the lower floor. We often have the kind of, you know, you often have the beer things in the lower floor. I wonder why that is. Maybe it's kind of the lower realms, right? That's what I think it is. It's almost down the bottom somewhere. And then as they were sitting down in this lower floor, drinking away, being heedless, not knowing what was going on, a fire broke out above them. And he could see how this fire was kind of spreading, right? And how the structure in the building was getting weak and things were starting to collapse. And then these young people down the bottom, they were so heedless that they just continued drinking. Oh yeah, we'll get that later on, right? There's still time, that kind of stuff. Until eventually the whole structure collapsed on top of them. And a number of people died in that fire. And for this monk, because his spiritual faculties were so sharp and so acute, he realized that this is a metaphor for life. We never get out in time. We never actually get doing those things that really matter. The world is burning around us. It's collapsing around us. But we don't escape. We don't do those things that lead out of this world, lead out of this kind of burning existence of ours. So for him, this was a metaphor for life itself. And when he saw this, this was the impulse that he needed to go off, travel far away to Sri Lanka and get ordained and then become a monastic. And he became one of those really exemplary monastics. He started off just like we are doing now, just reading the suttas, right? He didn't really have a teacher. His teacher was the suttas. So he spent 10 years on a famous monastery in Sri Lanka called the Island Hermitage, which is well away from everything else, just reading the suttas and meditating. And after 10 years, he thought, okay, I know the suttas well enough. Left all the books behind and started wandering around in Sri Lanka from like forest to forest, right? Just meditating, only really staying still for the rains retreat, finding good places to meditate and meditating there, and wandering around for about 35 years. And he would have been a monk like this, right? All he had was a robe and bowl, nothing else. And in his head, he had the Buddha's teachings, right? And then he practiced like that. And of course, when you live like that, and if you have your act together like that, it means that you are getting your joys and happinesses in life from somewhere else than ordinary people. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do that. Right? Just living quite rough, living in the forest, sleeping on the ground, all of these kind of things. It takes something. It is very inspiring precisely because you know this person has some inequality that other people don't have. And nobody knows exactly what he was. Many people say he was an Aryan, some people say he was an Arahant. Very hard to really know these things. These monks, they don't go around declaring, there's no sign on the chest saying Arahant or anything like that, right? So you don't really know that. But it is inspiring regardless. It is the feeling that the Dhamma is alive in the world when you see these kind of things. So here's one example. He's dead now. There is another monk also in Sri Lanka, and he is also European actually, and he is one of these monks who lives in the jungle all the time. He comes out 1 week every year to have a Dhamma discussion, and then he disappears back into the jungle, right? Very kind of, whoa, disappears, nobody sees him for a whole year, and then he kind of comes out again, discusses Dhamma for 1 week, and then disappears again, year after year after year, right? It's very nice. And he he lives in these, they have these special huts, the cuties they have, very kind of special kind of cuties there, that he designed himself. And these cuties, they have like three walls. This fourth wall is missing here. And the reason the fourth wall is missing is because he wanted these cuties to be like caves. Caves have one opening, right? Three walls, one opening. So he wanted these cuties to be like caves. So he would, that is where he stays, right? 51 weeks of the year. 1 week he stays with the other monks somewhere else. And then he walks into the village, which may be a few kilometers away, gets his alms food, walks back to his cutie, and that's how he lives his entire life. Right? Because it only has three walls, sometimes he says he wakes up in the morning and the snake is sleeping next to him. Right? So this is kind of, this is the life they have. And again, this monk too is very famous for his, for probably being an Aryan, being a noble person, because of the way he lives. So these are some examples. You have these examples here in Thailand as well, of monastics who are very special and very unique. You have monks like Ajahn Gamaha, who also stayed at Bodhinyana Monastery for a year. You may have heard these stories before. The very, very famous story, a very famous monk with a snake. And the snake story where often they would wander around from village to village in the early days here in Thailand as well. Then they would camp out in the forest. Then they would meditate in the forest in the evening and afternoon and early mornings. And one day he was meditating with all his other monks. Right, and as they were meditating, they heard this sound. Something was approaching. Right, okay, oh, no worry, just let it be. And it was approaching more and more and more. Until eventually they had to open their eyes to see what this was. And then when Ajahn Gamaha opened his eyes, he saw a king cobra. King cobra kind of raised up, its hood all out and kind of hissing towards him. Right? Imagine what that feels like when you have a king cobra. Most people kind of freeze, you would be in shock, you wouldn't know what to do. You probably, I don't know what would happen, you would probably, just like animals freeze when there's a snake, human beings do the same when you have really scary snakes like that. Ajahn Gamaha, because he's a really, really cool monk, right? In many means, this word has many meanings, but a cool monk in many, many different ways. Really cool, lots of metta means cool. So because he has so much metta, he's not afraid of anything. Metta takes away fear. This is one of the great reasons why developing metta is so beautiful. No fear anymore. So when he sees the snake, he knows that the snake is dangerous. So very, very slowly, he lifts up his hand, right? Lifts up his hand, puts it on top of the head of the king cobra, and pats the king cobra on the head. Right? And then said, "Thank you for visiting, snake. Very nice to meet you. Now it's time for you to go away." So he does it, and then the snake kind of goes away, right? And the other monks, they are really scared, absolutely stiff, and they don't really know what to do there. But this, again, is the kind of power of these things. Is this a real story? Did this really happen? Recently we had some of the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. They went to visit this monk, Ajahn Gamaha. He's still alive today. He's very close to Bodhinyana Monastery. I visited him myself earlier this year. And they asked him about this story, right? Because Western monks, they kind of ask him about these things. Thai monks probably be too scared to ask him about that. But Western monks, we ask him about these things. This is what is them. So they ask him, well, what snake? What happened to that snake? What did the snake feel? Right? What was going on? And Ajahn Gamaha said, "Well, I don't really know what the snake felt. You have to go and ask the snake." So what is nice about that, it shows you that probably it was a real story, right? Because they had a conversation about it afterwards. So probably that actually happened. It's quite astonishing that something like that happened, because it's just way out there in terms of, things. So again, very inspiring. How does anyone dare to do that, except if you have some very, very powerful inner qualities? Then you have things like Ajahn Brahm, who goes on a 6-month retreat, right? Doesn't speak to a single person for 6 months. He's had this cutie, 7 square meters, 3 meters by 2.5 meters, and he has the walking path. That's all he does for 6 months, is hang out in that cutie and the walking path. Nothing else. Actually, he did walk down. There was a box where he put his aunt's food. He would walk down to that box to pick up the aunt's food once a day here. Didn't see anyone for 6 months. And then he had one book. That was the Magic Manikaya, right? So he would read some suttas every now and again, continuously for 6 months. So again, it's very, very inspiring, especially when he comes on after 6 months. He says he can't really speak anymore because he hasn't spoken for 6 months. And his mind is so peaceful that he's basically almost incapable of thinking. Right? Most of us, we can't stop thinking. He can't think because his mind is so peaceful. He's the exact opposite of everyone else. So, because of that, the first Dhamma talk he gives after the 6 months, the title of the talk is 6 months of bliss, right? That's the title of the talk. Because for Ajahn Brahm, that is the highest kind of happiness you can have. Just to be by yourself, not having to see anybody, right? He's very friendly when he's around people, but he'd much rather not see us, right? Let's face the facts. He'd much rather be left to himself and do his own things. So the fact that he's friendly is just because, basically that's the way people are if you have that kind of development. So these are some of those people. Another monk who is also very interesting, this is another story that Ajahn Brahm tells when he was a young monk. This is a famous monk called Ajahn Tate. And Ajahn Tate, Ajahn Brahm went to visit him when he was young. He was traveling around the northeast of Thailand, the Isan, which is the northeast of Thailand, visiting the various different meditation masters. And one of them was Ajahn Tate. Ajahn Tate, very, very famous at that time. The king had built in this mandapa. Mandapa was this kind of big hall, right? And when Ajahn Brahm came, this was where he was sitting, in this big hall. And so Ajahn Brahm goes up to this hall and he thinks, yeah, this is my chance. I'm going to ask this great master all these questions. Right? So he goes into this main hall and he looks around. Where is he? Can't see anyone, can't see Ajahn Tate. And then he has to look twice and he sees this old monk sitting on a chair in the corner, right? I can barely see him because why is it that you can't see a monk like that? It's not that he has got psychic powers or he's invisible, that's not what it is. But it is that when you are so selfless, when you have so little sense of self, it is almost as if you disappear in a crowd. It's like if there was an arahant here, right? He was sitting over there, you might not even notice that they're here because they're so self-effacing. They don't actually make anything of themselves. And because of that, Ajahn Brahm couldn't see him. And then when he sees this monk, which is so selfless, it is like, and that selflessness also means a lot of metta. It means a lot of acceptance. He's never going to judge you in any way whatsoever, right? So when you come into the presence of a person like that, you become incredibly peaceful then. Ajahn Brahm says that when he came into the presence of this monk, and all the questions he had, they just disappeared. No more questions because of the peace of the situation. And then he felt kind of stupid, right? I don't have anything to say anymore. Why am I here? So he just goes to this monk and he bows down to him and pays his respect. And they have a kind of a short conversation. Even though you're arahant, you're still friendly to people. You're still kind. Right? How are you? You know, are you well? And there's a brief conversation about a few basic things. And this is another example of somebody who is very special. So remember this. There are, even in the present day, there are people like this in the world who live almost to this standard. And what is so powerful about it is that people who live so simply, it actually gives us this sense that there is something more in the world. There is something profound to be attained. Some happiness which can be found deep inside of us, which is available for everybody. It lifts your spirits, makes you feel, wow, actually, gives the world some extra meaning, which otherwise it wouldn't have if it wasn't for those people then. And also it says in a number of places in the suttas, it talks about, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha's final passing away, it talks about the qualities that will actually make Buddhism live for a long time or sustain itself for a long time in the future. And one of those qualities is that the monastic Sangha enjoys living in the forest. Right? This is one of the qualities, living in the forest and also enjoying that is one of the qualities that will ensure the survival of Buddhism into the future. That's how important it is. And it is that important precisely because it allows you to access these deeper things, and you can only do it if you have accessed them already. So think about these things. Allow these things to inspire you. I find all of these things very inspiring myself. So inspiring, I'm forgetting to drink my coffee, in fact. But that's a good sign that you are really getting inspired. So. So allow these things to inspire you, because they point to something profound in life, something very useful and something very nice. So. Okay, so that is the idea of contentment. Try to be content in your own life. Try just to say, you know, this is what I have is wonderful and great. Let me now search in a slightly different direction. Let me search in Buddhism on the spiritual path rather than all these worldly things that people normally try to find happiness. So, next passage here in the gradual training. Right. First of all, I should say that this passage on contentment is roughly equivalent to right livelihood in the Noble Eightfold Path. Right, this is the livelihood of monastics. You have your bowl, you go around, you collect alms food. This is roughly equivalent to right livelihood in the Noble Eightfold Path. And now, the next passage is called the Senses Grain Formula, known as the Indriya Sangvara Sila in Pali. Indriya are the senses, Sangvara like restraint, and Sila means like the habit or the character of that kind of restraint. So now we're moving on to right effort. This is an aspect of right effort. So you can see here how the path is developed, right? It starts off with the Buddha arising in the world. That is right view coming to existence. Somebody hears a teaching, they think, yeah, this is it, this is right view. So they attain right view as well. Then they get sammasankappa, I want to ordain, I want to practice this path, whatever it is. So the aim becomes right, they start doing the right thing. Then when the aim is right, they start practicing the virtue, sammavacha, sammakamanta, right action, right speech. Then you have a right livelihood. And then when all of that is in place, that is when the purification of the mind starts to happen. And this is what really comes into effect now with sense restraint. Already a little bit there with contentment, but definitely with sense restraint. So I will, as always, read out a little bit for you and then discuss it afterwards. So, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, bad, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. Because of that, he practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. Okay, so this is sense restraint, and then that's repeated for each of the six senses. In Buddhism we have six senses, we have the ordinary five, and we also have the mind as a sixth sense. So what is going on here? This is, I would never translate this in this way myself, because actually it's quite hard to understand what is going on when you read this. It's not obvious at all what is going on. But because I have been studying this for 20 years, I finally starting to become clear to me what is going on here after 20 years. So it takes a bit of knowledge of Pali. This is one of the great advantages of knowing Pali a little bit. You can go back to the source and then you can find out for yourself what actually is going on in this kind of situation. So what is happening here is that on seeing a form with the eye, it just means seeing something with the eye, right? Whatever it is, you can say, it's much better to say seeing a vision would be far better. So you see a vision, any kind of vision, okay. Right now, you're all seeing visions, right? Actually, well, that sounds a bit dubious in visions. You're seeing something right now. That is that form that is talking about here. And in particular, it refers to specific things that you see in that vision, right? Seeing people, right? Seeing whatever it is. Things that you see. Seeing a car, seeing a house. Specific things within that vision. So if you see that, it says here, you do not grasp its signs and features. So this is, again, very hard to understand. What does sign mean here? It's a weird word, right? What it means is just the object itself. So if you see something nice, you see a nice car going by, right? You think, whoa, that is a really cool car, right? And you kind of grow up, I've got to get one of those cars. I've got to go out and make some money real fast so I can buy that kind of car for myself. That is the sign, is the car. Very often it's about people, right? We grasp onto people. We see somebody we like, or we see somebody we don't like, right? This is the person. Now then the person, of course, also has features. There are aspects of that person. So we might just grasp onto the aspects of that person instead, or maybe aspects of the car, or whatever it is that we see. So this is what this means, right? It just means anything you see that you grasp. That's really what it means. Anything you see, whether it is an object, a person, parts of the person, the car, a nice house, whatever it is, all of that is included in this. So what does it mean to grasp this? It obviously doesn't mean holding on to it. That's a bit too, that's too literal, right? It obviously doesn't mean that. So what grasping here means is that if I see a person, I see somebody I like, and then the mind kind of follows along after. So even when that person had disappeared, you still think about, wow, I really like that person, I really like that car, right? And you find some attraction there. The mind kind of holds on to that image, and it holds on to the image in the mind. And then desire can arise, aversion can arise, depending on what kind of relationship you have with that person or with that car or whatever it is. So this is what it meant, right? You can start to see now what is going on here. Very, very simple, actually. It just means when you see things, then reactions to that seeing, that sometimes you like the stuff you see, sometimes you have aversion, you dislike the stuff you see. And that has an impact on your mind. I'm sure all of you can relate to that straight away. You know exactly what is meant, because this sort of stuff happens to us all the time, right? All the time, these things happen to us. So, this is what the person does not do. You don't grasp these things in this way. And this is what is going on here. And the reason why you don't grasp this is that if you did grasp it, if you left the eye faculty unguarded, right, then these evil, it says here, bad is better, unwholesome states, like qualities, right, of covetousness and greed might invade him or her, right, or whoever. So, again, this translation is really not very easy to understand. What does it mean that states of covetousness and grief might invade you? Well, first of all, the words covetousness and grief have really no relationship to what is going on here. Grief means, oh, somebody has died, somebody, you know, close to me is going, that's what grief means. It's terrible. You feel sorrow and grief. But covetousness means that you want the belongings of somebody else. That's quite literally what covetousness means. No, what is meant here is that the things that invade you are desire. The Pali word is abhijja. Quite literally means desire. You get desire for things, or the opposite of desire, which is aversion. You either like what you see or you dislike it. It's desire and aversion, like and dislike. This is what is meant by this. So we're now moving on to more refined aspects, right, of this path. So this is getting more refined. So this is what is meant by this. And once you understand what's going on, it becomes quite clear what is happening here. If you don't guard that eye faculty, if you're not aware of what is going on, then precisely desire and aversion in regard to the things you see, they can arise at any moment. You know exactly what is going on here once you start to see this. Evil, unwholesome qualities, bad, unwholesome qualities, better, unwholesome because they lead to dissatisfaction, they lead to craving, they lead to ill will, they lead to all of these kind of things that get you out of balance, right? Makes you feel kind of unsatisfied, discontent, makes you feel yucky basically. And if you don't want to feel yucky, then you've got to avoid this kind of stuff. So what do we do with this? So what we do, he says here, first of all, the idea of guarding the eye faculty, right? So how do we do that? Guarding means that you have mindfulness. You are aware of what is going on. It is not something that is always very easy to do because we see things very fast. Things have happened very quickly. But the idea is you have mindfulness. So you see how you react to the things around you. You can feel your reactions fairly quickly. Because you feel your reactions fairly quickly, then you can take a countermeasure. If you have absolutely no mindfulness, if you're kind of wandering around and kind of, with fantasizing about things, not knowing what is going on, then of course your mind, you get taken for a ride all the time. Your mind gets out of control. You're just desiring this, having aversion to that all the time. So the idea here is that you have a sense of you're standing back a little bit from the world. You're not completely immersed in the world. The ability to stand back and see things clearly, that's what mindfulness is all about. Mindfulness can be weak, it can be strong, but some degree of mindfulness is required. So I'm sure you know exactly, it's actually very simple, right? We all know what this means in our daily life. Suddenly you see yourself being attracted to something. Suddenly you see somebody you don't like, and you get a sense of aversion. Right? This happens all the time. And we all have some degree of mindfulness as to what is going on. The point here is that you want to catch it as early as possible, because with all states, with all things in life, if that desire, if the ill will becomes strong, very hard to get rid of, right? You catch it as early as possible. That's why mindfulness ideally should be quite strong in these situations. So then, when you have sufficient mindfulness and you catch yourself, you see all this attraction and aversion arising in the mind, the most important thing to get some kind of control over is the aversion, right? Especially in lay life, it is very hard to give up all kind of desires. So don't worry too much about the desire part. Much more important is to get rid of the aversion part, because that is where the ill will, the anger, and all that kind of stuff happens. And it is so unpleasant. It makes life so miserable when we have these kind of negative reactions to the world around us. So once you have enough mindfulness, then what do? Then you practice the restraint of the eye, right? You undertake the restraint of the eye. So the fact that you're guarding the eye allows you then to restrain the eye. And this is kind of the crucial issue here. What does restrain the eye actually mean? And this is where we have to be very careful. If we understand this idea of restraining in the wrong way, then we are basically already heading in the wrong direction. In English, the word restrain usually means like using force, using willpower. We talk about restraining orders, right? And when somebody's getting out of hand, you've got to call the police and say, okay, please, keep them away from me. They are stalking me and that sort of stuff. Okay, so put a restraining order. It means force, right? The police literally can hold that person back from getting into your presence if they become a nuisance. But this is not what it means in Buddhism. This is not what it means here. It does not actually mean using too much force on the mind. The main purpose, the main idea of restraint in Buddhism is just the idea that you are changing the way you're looking at the situation. You're changing in such a way that that aversion or that desire does not arise in the mind. That is what is meant by this. And to just give you some idea of how this is done. It's not rocket science. It can be difficult because we have to go against our habits, but it's not hard to understand how you do this. So if you see somebody who really tends to upset you, right? There's always sometimes people who upset us in life. That's just what life is like sometimes. So what do you do when that happens? There's two things you can do. Either you can just get away from that person straight away, because you can see if I hang around here for too long, it's going to upset me. So in other words, you are changing your attention. You start attending to something else. You walk away or you go somewhere else. That means you are changing your attention to some other object, right? This is one way of restraining yourself. And sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it's okay to just walk away, right? This is too difficult. Don't I have to deal with this situation? Okay, so you just walk away. You go somewhere else. You try not to make it too obvious or you kind of hurt somebody's feelings. But you can see that the situation is kind of moving in a bad direction. So you do something like that. There's an alternative to that. And the alternative way of doing restraint here is to look at that person in a different way. And this is one of the things that I will talk about later on. People are complicated and people have many aspects to them. So instead of looking at that negative quality in the person, you change your perception and you see the positive qualities in that person instead. Right? That is what you do. So this is what is meant by restraint. And the ability to change your perspective like that, to look at the situation in a different way, that is called wisdom power. Right? You may have heard Ajahn Brahm use the term wisdom power, right? This is really what wisdom power consists of. You understand the situation, you see the danger, and you use your wisdom to look at the situation in a different way. And when you do that, wow, it just disappears. No aversion, no anger, all of these things just disappear like that straight away. It's very beautiful, right? It's very beautiful, very powerful, and remarkably, it is not actually that difficult to do. Maybe you think this sounds really hard, I'm not sure if I can do this. Sure, of course you can do this. All it takes is a bit of perseverance, a bit of interest in the Dhamma, and just keep on doing these things. And certainly you can do it. Everyone here has the ability to do this kind of things. You just have to want it first of all, right? Do you want to get rid of the ill will and negativity in your mind? If you want to, then you can do it by following this particular recipe called sense restraint. So the critical thing there is to have enough mindfulness to see that the mind is about to walk into aversion and negativity. And when you have enough mindfulness, you have to have the wisdom to be able to change your attention in a different direction. That's all it takes, right? There's nothing more to it than that. And that is what is meant here by sense restraint. And this is what I've been reading out now is just the idea. This is about the eye, and this is equally true for all the other senses, right? We have the ear, and we have the, especially the ear, also sometimes we can hear a lot of stuff, but it's not very nice. So the ear is particularly, this is also a place where this problem arises very often, but all the six senses are mentioned here. So smelling, tasting, and touching, touching things with the body, and lastly also the mind itself. So I'll just read out again so we can kind of get this summarized one more time. So on knowing a mind, the mental thing with the mind, he does not grasp at the signs and the features. Or he does not grasp the object or any feature of the object. Since if he left the mind unguarded, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would invade him. So because of that, he practices the way of its restraint. He practices the wisdom power, not the willpower. And he guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. Possessing this noble restraint of the mind of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. So here you have all the six senses. You practice in the same way. You practice the restraint using the wisdom power. This is a phrase that Ajahn Brahm always uses, and I'm always very pleased when I see that the suttas and the way your teacher teaches that match up very nicely. It's a very beautiful thing when that happens. This is what happens in this case. So I want to go back just a little bit, because there was one phrase I forgot to talk about before in the paragraph on contentment, the very last phrase, it says, possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. Or you can say, the bliss of blamelessness, the bliss of the fact that you are blameless. And this is a very important part of this paragraph, and for that reason I shouldn't just kind of pass over it without mentioning this. This is precisely what we were talking about before, the idea that when you live a life well, you start to feel good about yourself. The better you live it, the more you are able to do all of these factors, especially the right speech and the right conduct, and also now moving on to the mind, the more you're able to do that in the right way, the more happy you're going to feel about yourself. You just feel naturally happy about yourself because you know you are living the life well, right? So this is so important, and this is part of the thing when I talked about the sila and the sati before, is part of that, the idea of recalling your own character, your own habits, your own who you are. So you don't feel bad about yourself because you don't do bad stuff, and you feel specifically good about yourself because you actually habitually do good things. And together they become this bliss of blamelessness. You are blameless, and you think, wow, how wonderful it is to be blameless, right? Whoa, I am blameless. And it kind of, this is a natural feeling of just being glad inside of you. And so this is a very important part of this. And now you can see that this is then expanded in this next sutta. Again, we're talking about the bliss, but this time it's called the bliss that is unsullied. So this is a higher type of bliss. Based on the bliss of blamelessness, you move on to the next stage. And the next stage is the bliss that is unsullied. It's unsullied because even though you are blameless, if the mind has all kinds of aversion and anger and ill will and lots of powerful desires, the bliss isn't pure because it is like dirtied by these negative factors in the mind. So by reducing these negative factors in the mind, that bliss becomes more pure and more powerful. Right? The bliss is increasing. And this is one of those wonderful things about this path. Wherever you read the sutras, it is always about this hierarchy of blisses. One bliss more blissful than the other bliss. Right? Adam Brahm's book said, bliss upon bliss upon bliss is kind of one of the subtitles of one of Adam Brahm's books. It just goes on, more and more bliss. And this is kind of the powerful thing about this Buddhist path. And when you get to the real, there's so much bliss here. And of course, down the line, there's even more powerful blisses. But on the way to those really, really powerful blisses, there's many kind of subsidiary blisses that are really, really great in their own right. So every aspect, every part of this path, you should enjoy to the maximum, because there's so much potential for happiness there. Don't go thinking, oh, when will I get jhanas, right? I want jhanas now, give me the jhanas. Don't think like that, because there's so much happiness to be had before that. Enjoy those happinesses. If all we do is go around, pining to, oh, I want jhana, you're never going to get anything, and you will destroy those little happiness at the same time. So enjoy what you have, forget about those blooming jhanas, right? They are great, but they will happen in their own time. You can't control them. So there's no point in expecting something you can't control. That's the point, it's madness to try to expect something. It will happen in its own time. And if you expect it, it's crazy because you have no idea when it's going to happen. So enjoy the little happiness, enjoy the little blisses. As you do that, it will happen all by itself. It will bloom into this beautiful lotus eventually. And you will be really, really, really happy. You feel your life becomes meaningful as a consequence. Instead of all the meaningless lives that we see around this world today, I think sometimes the world these days is pretty, it's pretty sad actually, the kind of aspirations people have in their lives. I saw some kind of statistic recently about the aspirations that young people have these days compared to only what it was like 15, 20 years ago. 15, 20 years ago, it was more about community and, looking after each other. That's what this was done in the UK, I think. But these days, the number one aspiration among young people was nothing to do with community. the number one aspiration was to be a celebrity, right? Isn't that quite terrible? It's kind of, what kind of happiness is that? That's what the Buddha called, you know, he called it some really bad words, that kind of happiness. He called it something like urine happiness or something like that, really kind of the low sort of happiness. There's nothing there. It's kind of empty. There's kind of this build-up of this glossy stuff, but actually has no content. That is the kind of things that we celebrate and we worship in the present day. Well, hopefully those young people, they're hopefully just a bit stupid while they're young. These are people, kind of teenagers, right? And we've all been there. I remember being a teenager, and I'd rather not remember all the stupidity I did when I was a teenager. So we can forgive them for that. Hopefully they will become more mature later on. So anyway, that is the sensory strength aspect of the gradual training. And I will just read out one short little sutta as before. We call it a close for this afternoon. And that is a sutta called The Two Powers from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's a very simple little sutta, but it gives you some idea again about this thing I was calling wisdom power over willpower. So this is how this sutta works. I'm not sure what page you have it there, but don't worry too much about that because it's easy to understand. Bhikkhus, monks, there are these two powers. What two? The power of reflection and the power of development. And what is the power of reflection? Here, someone reflects in this way. Bodily misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Verbal misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Mental misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Having reflected thus, he abandons bodily misconduct and develops bodily good conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops verbal good conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops good mental conduct. He maintains himself in purity. This is called the power of reflection. Right? This is what you're seeing here is Buddhist morality in its form. It includes the bodily activities, it includes speech activities, it also includes the mind, right? And how do we get to that purity in all of these things? It is not through willpower, it is not through meditation, right? It doesn't say that. The way we get to purity in all of these areas is by reflection, is by thinking in the right way, right? And this is what is meant here. And this is why I say that sensory strength is all about wisdom power. Because by reflecting, by thinking about things, thinking about people, thinking about the world in the right way, keeping the right kind of perceptions in our mind, looking at people in the appropriate way, that is how we overcome the negative things in life, the negative conduct, negative morality, and build up the positive morality instead. Right? It's by reflection. It's wisdom power. It's not just by using force, right? Willpower, yeah, I'm going to kind of, you know, use it. And that is a wonderful thing here. And the reason it is so wonderful is because willpower is often so painful. Not only is it painful, but actually it's very weak, right? Willpower doesn't get you anywhere. There are all these experiments that have been done about human willpower. And basically we suck at willpower. So because we suck at willpower, it's good that we don't have to use any willpower. Because we just can't do it. So that is why wisdom power is really so important. And wisdom power is such a beautiful thing. Because when you use wisdom power and you use it in the right way, the problems just disappear, bang, like that, and they're gone. That's what wisdom power can do for you. Willpower, all it can do is suppress things. And as soon as you get tired of using willpower, bang, you lift the willpower and it comes back, blows back into your face again. Wisdom power, because it sees through the problem, it actually abandons the problem at a much more deep-rooted way. And for that reason, it is so incredibly powerful. So all you have to do is to learn to look at things in a different way. I was talking about this a little bit earlier on already, about how to look at people's good qualities rather than the bad qualities, how to have compassion for people who are completely bad, and all of these kind of things. Very simple things, but incredibly powerful in helping us to overcome negativity, ill will, and all these kind of things. So, and then we have the other power, and that is the power of development. And of course, that power is precisely, that is what meditation is all about, right? Secluded from sensual pleasures, one enters upon the first jhana, etc. Or it is also explained as the bhujangas. The bhujangas is just another way of talking about meditation practice. So, development is about meditation practice, but being moral, doing the right thing in the world, is all about reflection and how we think about the world. And that, I think, is very interesting because it shows us that just by reading the suttas, learning how to think in the right way, wow, we can actually go a long, long way on this Buddhist path. Okay, so that is all for now. So, all I have left to do is finish up my coffee. That's really good, isn't it? Okay, great. So, we'll see you again this evening. So, meet at 8 o'clock as usual, Andy? Yeah, great. So, we'll see you again at 8 o'clock this evening. In the meantime, let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
With it.